Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network, where we bring together official Washington, D.C. insiders and AI experts who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence. Today, a special guest who's on the cutting edge of AI and is also filling in all the blanks on how we got here, Jeremy Kahn, is Fortune Magazine's AI editor, and his book, Mastering AI, A Survival Guide to Our Superpowered Future, is must read. He calls for government action on AI safety and X risk, licensing, certification, and inspection. Jeremy, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much. Great to be here.
I'm going to begin with the last sentence in the book, quote, "If this is indeed the last invention humanity ever creates, we'd better make it good." How did you end up there?
There is this idea that this could potentially be sort of the invention that you use to invent every other invention, and therefore is in essence the last fully man-made invention. And that's an idea that actually people started talking about in the 1960s with AI. But I think as AI is starting to really live up to the promise that it had held for so many years and never really delivered on, as it looks like that promise is more deliverable now than ever before, I think we really need to start thinking about that idea that this could really be the last fully man-made, human-invented invention, and that everything else we do will be assisted in some way by AI technology. And if that's the case, I really think we need to be very deliberate about how we develop this technology. We better make sure it's really good.
Well, I'm going to get to the people that are behind the technology. But what I like about the book, too, is that you give some solutions, some recommendations to make sure that it all works well and the world is actually advanced because of it. So I'm going to start with robot tax. This idea that companies, instead of just replacing workers, that there would be a tax on the actual technology so that what? It'll be reskilling, or what do you recommend?
I think the tax is important just to provide some incentive for people and businesses that are deploying the technology not to think of the technology as simply a substitute for human labor, which is frankly, I mean, I talked to a lot of business executives. When you get them in private, that is basically the first place most of them go. It's the obvious thing to do in some ways, the way the technology has been framed, to think of it as a way to save on labor cost and to think of it as a direct substitution in many ways for human labor. But actually, a lot of the problems that potentially we face with this technology, a lot of the risks really come from this idea that the technology will somehow be used as a direct substitute for human skills and human tasks. And I think instead, if we start thinking of the technology as a complement to human labor, as something that is going to be a co-pilot for human workers, not a replacement for them, then you avoid, first of all, a lot of the risks that are sort of inherent to the technology. You also sidestep some of the big concerns about unemployment and displacement. And I think you end up in a much better place overall. But the question is, how are you going to incentivize businesses to do this? And one way would be with a tax on businesses that would be using the technology simply as a replacement for human labor. This is not a completely original idea to me. I should credit Eric Brynjolfsson, who's a labor economist at Stanford. He has also sort of proposed the same thing and also sees that division between looking at the technology as a complement for human labor as opposed to a substitute as one of the key decisions we need to make. And he has also suggested a robot tax as one way you might incentivize business to do this. Now, there's various ways you could design a robot tax. And I think actually the simplest, which I propose in the book, is if a company seems to be doing well, if it's growing its top line and its profits, and yet at the same time shedding workers while deploying some sort of automation, then I think it should be subject to a robot tax, because then obviously the automation is helping it. I am wary of the idea that all businesses that deploy automation should be taxed, because you may have some businesses that are actually in quite desperate straits and that are not growing, and they see automation as the only way to save essentially a dying industry or a dying business. And I'm not sure that that's where you want to deploy taxes. But I think if you're making outsized profits and the business is growing and yet you're shedding workers while deploying an AI technology, those businesses should be subject to a tax. And that's a fairly simple way to have the tax be applied. There are much more complicated proposals some economists have come up with, where you actually have to figure out the marginal cost of things and the competitive advantage. You have to actually calculate the human versus the machine. I think that's much more complicated and very difficult to apply, whereas what I'm proposing is much simpler. But the idea would be, yes, those companies that are doing well and using automation to grow would be subject to a tax, and the tax would only be in the case that they're shedding workers. So the idea would be it would encourage them to look at the technology as something that could be complementary to workers, to encourage them to think of reskilling their existing workforce, thinking about what other roles they can shift workers to. So you don't just have this case where, as often happens, particularly in the US, where companies just decide to fire workers, and then the reskilling effort really has to be financed by the government. And it becomes somebody else's problem how these workers find other jobs and how they reskill themselves.
In the book, you talk about AI's tendency to help the best performers earn even more, upending professions, and really having peak performers take over. What's your recommendations to prevent that?
This is just a dynamic that we're going to have to be aware of. And I think the government needs to be a little bit mindful as how this dynamic plays out across industries. There is a tendency, I think, because AI depends essentially on three things, which are algorithms, data, and compute. The algorithms are becoming increasingly commoditized. Everyone has access essentially to the same kinds of AI algorithms. They're available through various third parties. Some of them are available open source. So that's less a differentiator. What is a differentiator still is compute, which costs a lot of money, and data. And it tends to be the largest companies that have access to the most data to potentially fine tune an AI system to perform the best in that particular industry niche. And I think there'll be a tendency for the biggest companies in each industry, if they get this right, and there's no telling that they necessarily will, but if they do, there'll be this tendency to concentrate power. So I do think government needs to watch that. And you have to have organizations such as the FTC watching carefully what happens with the concentration of power within industries. But then I think within professions, which we're talking about individuals, there's also going to be a tendency for the top performing individuals to possibly go off on their own because they will need less support staff than they did before. That will particularly apply in areas like accounting and law. It might apply to wealth advisors, consultants to some degree, where they will have the ability to not need such large firms as they have in the past. And you can have more boutiques. You might find big rainmakers go off and form kind of boutique firms with just themselves or a few people because they just won't need the support network. A lot of that support work can be done by AI systems now.
Well, you go in depth into what's happening in the legal community and these firms that have already come out. But the problem is, if you don't have young people who are learning from experts, you depend more on machines. The other thing you talk about is going from AI chatbots to the actual digital agents that'll do everything for us. Can you talk about that?
I think we are very quickly going to be in this world of AI agents. Lots of tech companies working on them right now. They're going to start being rolled out, perhaps even by the end of this year. Salesforce is actually the first company, I think, to announce a product that is an agent that can perform a number of sales-related tasks for people, not just generate content. So not just generate the email that you're going to send to the sales contact, but actually go and potentially book something in a system for you, perform tasks with other software across the internet. But increasingly, we're going to all have access to these AI agents that are going to do these things for us. That is kind of the next phase of this development. But that carries risk because now you're not just generating a piece of content that a human can look at. The agent has actually gone and done something using the internet, potentially involving transactions. I do think we have to be wary about the risks involved in that and have good guardrails in place about what those agents can do, and also some good rules about who should be liable if the agent goes astray. Where does responsibility and accountability lie for any mistakes that the agent makes? Because I think it's going to be quite possible to imagine scenarios in which people give not very clear instructions to an AI agent. It goes out and does something, and then the person says, wait a second, you just bought this very expensive thing that I did not intend to have bought. And then what happens? And I don't think we figured that out yet, but I think we need to figure that out very soon. I think that's an area of risk that we are quickly entering. But you also talked about how do we train young people. And I suggest in the book that one way we can think about training people, particularly in these professions like law and accounting, is to go back to an apprenticeship model that existed before these firms all got so big. If you go back to the turn of the 20th century or the 19th century, lawyers, for instance, had smaller firms and they would have trainees. They would have apprentices who worked right at the shoulder or elbow of the senior lawyer. And that is how they learned. They were clerks that worked right alongside the senior lawyer. And it's really only in the second half of the 20th century, the firms got so large and they started deploying these huge classes of associates that they would hire in from law school that were kind of like cannon fodder. They would get some training, but they were mostly there to bill lots of billable hours to the client and to work on legal research and due diligence for large deals or major litigation. It enabled those firms to handle much larger cases than they could before or do deals in timeframes they could not otherwise. But training was secondary to the purpose of those masses of associates. If we can now handle those deals using AI with far fewer people, there's still going to be a way to train people, but I think we're going to have to go back to a more traditional apprenticeship model.
What governments What institutions do you think will lead on any of these issues? Because I haven't seen any of it.
Yeah. Well, I think there's been very little in the U.S. at the federal level. There's been a lot of talk and very little action so far. But there's stuff happening at the state level, which is kind of interesting. We're starting to see some things in Connecticut. We've seen some things in Illinois and then, of course, in California. So it is possible that states will lead on some of the rules on this. I think the FTC and under the Biden administration has put out some signals that it cares about the size and concentration of power within industries. And I think the FTC is an organization that could take steps to deal with some of these issues. And the Commerce Department in general, I think, could potentially create some rules about accountability and liability around AI agents, for instance. When it comes to training regimes and programs, I think that's much more within professions. And I think you're going to see some of that action take place at the level of states again with the state professional bodies, whether it's the bar associations or the state public accounting boards. I think they may be where you see some of the innovation occur and some of the debate about how do you train people for the profession and how does it work going forwards. I know a number of universities, they are already envisioning what does the future look like and how do we teach our students and prepare them for this new world of these professions where AI is going to be ubiquitous and everyone's going to have access to an AI copilot that's going to perform some of these tasks for lawyers or for accountants. So I do think in terms of educating the next generation, some of that work's already taking place at universities.
But the issue is all these current LLMs all have ingested all of this information. What you're talking about are remedies after the fact, right?
Yes.
Because how do you pull the biases out? How do you get government to step in? Whether we're talking about the FTC, we talked a little bit before we started about the California legislation, the variety of legislation where they really push. And it looks like that state is more likely to get things done and maybe lead the way. But at the end of the day, it's already been out of the bag.
I think you're not wrong. The LLMs are trained on the internet's worth of data and have ingested all those biases. I think there are ways with filtering technology that you could filter outputs. There are also some interesting ideas for putting in more robust guardrails, like Anthropic, which is an AI company that was formed by people who broke away from OpenAI. They have this idea of constitutional AI that I talk about a bit in the book. It does seem like that is a more robust idea for putting guardrails in place around things like bias, where you actually give very explicit instructions to the LLM on every response. It has to try to check itself against this written constitution. You could write whatever you want in that constitution, of course, but one of the ideas might be that you write that the output should not be unfair to any particular group or set of minorities. They recognize that this is a problem. They said, well, the constitution, the AI that they initially rolled out, they wrote the constitution, which they realized was sort of problematic. Like in a democracy, why does this private company get to write the constitution that's going to govern what an AI system can do? Now, it's their own system. So maybe in that particular case, it's fine. But they did acknowledge the wider point that as these systems roll out, there's going to be debate about what should be in this constitution. And they even did some public engagement around this and polling. And the problem is they found that like about 2/3 of the people agreed on what they thought should be in an AI constitution. But the other third vehemently disagreed with the 2/3 about what should be in there. And you had some people who were very much more on the libertarian fringe of things and really thought you should err on the side of giving maximum leeway to the AI to respond however it wished and not to worry about whether people were potentially offended by the output of the AI system or whether it was biased in some way. And other people disagree, and they really feel like we should be correcting the historical human biases in these systems, and that should be mandated. Again, I think this will play out. It is possible to envision that countries will mandate that people take steps to mitigate certain biases. Although I think we're going to probably look at that as biases and outcome. It'll be more relevant when we move into this world of AI agents where they're taking action. I think it's very hard to think about how we're going to police the actual content produced. I think it's still going to have to be humans that do that and judge whether that content that's produced by an AI, if it's biased in some way, would rise to the level of a violation of current federal rules around non-discrimination and that sort of thing. But I think when we move to the world of AI agents, it's possible we'll see governments intervene and say, if you're using them, if you're the company deploying them or the individual deploying them, you are responsible for the actions that they take. And if they take actions that have a negative consequence for some protected group, you are responsible just as if you took that action yourself.
What country do you think will be ahead on that? We look EU, we look at their legislation, but almost every country on the side will say, my God, we wish we could scale like the U.S.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I think that's a problem. I mean, there's this thing, the U.S. innovates and the EU regulates. I'm sure you've heard that before. And it's definitely true in AI. There are a couple interesting AI companies out of Europe, but not as many nearly as in the U.S. And they are not at the forefront in quite the same way. And yeah, the EU is way ahead on regulation of AI. And the EU AI Act is interesting. And you do actually see the US states that are enacting AI regulation borrow aspects of the EU AI Act. And that's even true at the federal level. If you look at what the Biden administration has mandated the NIST, which is part of the Commerce Department, the National Institute of Science and Technology, to come up with these standards, it has talked about a risk-based system of standards, and that risk assessment is very much something that is in the EU AI Act. So yes, I think the EU is ahead on this, but actually the other country that doesn't get mentioned as ahead on this is China. China has very strict rules on what its consumer AI products can do. The Chinese, of course, are very concerned that these systems would be subversive in some way, that they would encourage ways of thinking the Chinese regime doesn't actually want, or that they would be detrimental to social cohesion, which the Chinese government cares very much about. So they've actually banned some very strict rules on what the outputs of this can be. And there's very strict penalties for the Chinese AI companies that if they were to violate those rules. So sometimes people in the U.S. use China as a kind of this boogeyman. If we regulate, the Chinese will get ahead of us and we'll lose our advantage and they'll come to dominate us. This technology is so powerful that we can't afford to let the Chinese get ahead. But they fail to realize that the Chinese are regulating technology, at least in terms of its consumer uses, far more than we are. And of course, that does not deal with military uses of technology. And I think you kind of have to separate the two. It is true that the Chinese rules do not apply to whatever it's doing in terms of national security applications of AI, but they wouldn't necessarily have to apply either in the US. If the concern is that we're somehow going to lose a national security advantage by legislating, I don't think that's necessarily the case.
Let's turn to global warfare. Terrible tragedy in Gaza was the first time I saw someone wrote about the use of AI in deploying bombs. I still don't know if it was true or not that the AI chose the actual places to bomb, which was the first time. Maybe not the first time. I don't know. But can we talk about the larger issue of AI's use in warfare?
This is one of the areas I'm most concerned about. It's truly terrifying, I think, what's happening. We are moving into a situation where some of the doomsday scenarios that human rights campaigners have worried about for decades, literally for the last 14 years, they've been trying to get some sort of ban or at least limits on the deployment of what are called lethal autonomous weapons at the UN. And yet for the last 14 years, they have not made progress. And in that campaign, some of the things that those campaigners were worried about was the idea of small drones that could be used to target individuals on the battlefield and could kind of be these assassination bots. And we're very close to that now. If you look at the technology being deployed both in Ukraine and, yes, some of the things that have happened in Gaza. The Gaza situation is particularly interesting, I think, in some ways, because it's not necessarily that it's a completely automated system. It is not that the drones themselves are necessarily selecting the targets. Instead, you have a targeting system that is recommending targets to a human intelligence officer who is supposed to approve or disapprove those targets. And then they task some sort of weapon. In some cases, it is an AI weapon to go to the target and destroy it. The issue has been in Gaza that there's been some reporting from some of the Israeli journalists, some very good investigative reporting, where they've talked to some of these intelligence officers anonymously and have been told that they had very little information about why the AI system had recommended particular targets. And they were under a lot of pressure to approve targets and find more targets to strike. And so they ended up kind of rubber stamping the recommendations of this AI system so that you had ostensibly a human in the loop. But in practice, the human really wasn't exercising any meaningful control. The way human rights law works right now is that armies are supposed to exercise what's called meaningful control over any weapons that they deploy. And AI really makes that difficult. Some people said that actually a fully automated weapon would never meet the current rules of warfare because it would be impossible for a commander to say that they had continued to exercise meaningful control over the actual strike on that target. This is a tricky situation because you have this fine line between something like a decision support system, which is what the Israelis claim the AI that they're using is, and the actual kind of full automation. Here you have something where there is supposed to be decision support, but if you can't actually exercise meaningful control because you don't understand why the target was chosen, then basically it's just as bad as if it were fully automated.
You write about the Reaper drones that were used in Afghanistan and were piloted from Nevada, 7,000 miles away, but they are still considered enemy combatants and could be in a lot of trouble under the Geneva Conventions. Do you think AI will make wars longer or shorter?
I think they will make wars more deadly for both civilians and certainly for combatants. And I worry that it could make wars more total. What I was talking about with the Reaper pilots is there was this idea that, yes, they were sitting in Nevada, but they were still combatants. It still would have been okay under the rules of warfare if the Taliban, for instance, had wanted to strike them on their bases in Nevada. That would have actually been okay under the rules of war. And the thing that you're getting into also with Ukraine, where you have the drone operas several hundred miles, in some cases, from the front, is that the Russians have gotten very good at thinking that, well, we need to take out not just the drone at the front line, we need to really go after the operation center. So one idea is that if you have increasingly AI systems that are calling on, for instance, data centers that are located maybe thousands of miles away, do those data centers become legitimate targets in warfare? And then do you essentially get a kind of escalatory effect where wars tend to trend very quickly towards being kind of total warfare, as a situation where you're striking targets that are actually thousands of miles away on the home front, as it were. And those are legitimate targets because they're controlling military assets that are on the front line somewhere in a completely different geography. And I think that's an interesting case where, yes, you might see a kind of expansion of warfare through the use of AI systems.
What do you think about Brazil banning X, how they're attaching Starlink, and now Elon Musk's overall role in every country with every company he has, just trying to dominate everything?
Well, I think Musk is a fascinating character, but a very problematic figure also. He's clearly a libertarian, but not every country agrees with his political positions. And I do think it's problematic if he goes into a country and feels like he can violate their laws, if they happen to have laws around speech and content moderation, and he is not abiding by them, that's a problem. If he's going to operate in that country, he should abide by whatever the local rules are, or he should be prepared to take the consequences, which might be, in this case, a ban. It's interesting that they're also linking this to his other companies, Starlink and Xlink. But on the other hand, Elon himself is often linked what he does with one company to what he does with another. There's a lot of fluidity between his business operations, both in terms of personnel and how they're operated. So I think it's somewhat legitimate that Brazil's doing that. They're obviously trying to apply quite a bit of leverage on him, too, in every way they can. I don't fault Brazil for doing that. Again, he's an interesting character. I sort of agree with some of what he says about some of the big risks with AI. I disagree with other parts of it. One of his ideas is that he really thinks that everyone should have access to really powerful AI, that that's the best way to prevent it from being controlled by just a handful of corporations. I think his concern about control in the hands of just a few corporations is right, but I don't think necessarily giving everyone access to something super powerful is the right way to deal with that situation. He has tried to develop his own AI called Grok AI. So far, it's not clear how serious that effort is. It's certainly not one of the AI systems that's currently ranked at the top of the various.
And also, he was the original investor in OpenAI, and then they're a target, and then they're not a target. And it feels as if Sam Altman and Elon Musk are traveling the world trying to get folks on either one of their sides. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously they were at one point close, but they've clearly fallen out. And yes, I think Elon is very much opposed to OpenAI now. I don't know if Sam views Elon as much of a threat as Elon views Sam, but it's clear that there's no love lost between them now. Elon has definitely tried to line people up against OpenAI.
And OpenAI came out early and said for elections, anyone that's misusing their content, they're going to take them off the platform. And but we don't see that with other companies. Are they in the lead? Do you think it makes a big difference?
I think it can make a difference at the margins. I think the problem is always going to be that if you really want to do something nefarious with this technology, if you really want to influence elections in some covert way, you're just going to use a fake account to create this stuff. And once you've done that, there's very little they can do to kind of, once you've created the content, to put it back in the bottle. What OpenAI can do is they can ban your account, but it's not clear if you're a bad actor, if you're going to care that your account's been banned. You've already used the technology the way you want. The other thing that you have now is quite a lot of these open AI models, including from companies like Meta, where there really isn't even a possibility for the company that developed the AI model to control how it's being used once it's put out onto something like Hugging Face. And you can download the whole model to a local machine and use it however you wish. And there's nothing Meta can do at that point. Again, they can ban you from downloading a future model, for instance, if they know who you are and if you don't use a fake account. But these are very weak ways of trying to control something.
Let's go back to the book and your predictions on AGI and ASI. Superintelligence, oh my God, you've got me nervous about that.
Yeah. Well, we should be a little nervous about it, but not too terrified because I don't think it's something that's going to happen that imminently. luckily, when it comes to both AGI, which is artificial general intelligence, which would be like a system that's as smart as the average person, or artificial superintelligence, which is even further away technology, which would be a single AI system that would be as smart as all of humanity collectively, or smarter than all of humanity collectively. I think both of those technologies are not that imminent. I think we are sort of closer than we've ever been. We're on a path where you could conceivably see us getting there. But I think we still have time to kind of figure this out and to try to put in place some sensible guardrails and safety controls and some governance mechanisms before we would get to that point. I don't think AGI is likely to occur in the next 5 years. Maybe it's possible in that time frame. Maybe it's possible in 10 years. I don't know. I think superintelligence is probably several decades away if we're ever going to get there. Don't panic, but yeah, it's good to be a little nervous. It's enough of a risk that we should have some smart people spending some time and some amount of money trying to figure out how we would take some of these X risks off the table, or at least mitigate that potentiality.
Well, you talk about teaching AI a set of values. We've already talked about constitutional AI. There's opportunity there, but the companies that are leading are more focused on getting to AGI than anything else.
There is this kind of race dynamic going on where the companies are very much racing one another and they want to get there first. And I think that's potentially a very dangerous dynamic. There are companies like Anthropic that seem to care a lot about AI safety, but they also care very much about getting to AGI. And so there's tension there. And OpenAI was very much like that also. If you went back just 3 years ago to OpenAI, I think it would have seemed very much the same. And actually what's happened is the commercial incentives have gotten so great that now a lot of the safety researchers have now left. They are increasingly a product-focused company, but they very much want to get to AGI first. And I think if they saw an opportunity to get there, they would take it. And it's not clear what role safety would play in that conversation. I think we should all be concerned about that dynamic.
Let's do a lightning round on the companies. Will Microsoft unseat Google?
No.
Will Search GPT hurt Google?
Yes.
Will NVIDIA succeed in branching out beyond making chips to selling AI models and cloud computing capacity?
Yes, they already are, actually.
Oh, do tell.
I mean, NVIDIA's, that's clearly the strategy, and they already offer models and they're already offering their own cloud for AI computing tasks. They are clearly moving what's called up the stack when it comes to this technology. That's clearly part of Jensen's strategy. It's an interesting one because everyone's getting in everyone else's space, and it's unclear if some of that's strategic because the current algorithm offering companies like Google and Microsoft are also moving down the stack. They have for several years had their own hardware. They're more interested than ever in creating their own hardware to compete with NVIDIA. They're going to get into NVIDIA's business. NVIDIA is saying, we'll get into your business too. And that gives them all some leverage in these discussions. It's an interesting dynamic, but definitely NVIDIA is moving that way.
All right. Meta, open source. Are they going to be the leader?
They are, I would say right now, the leader in open source. I think there'll be the question still about how far you can push the open source models in terms of performance. But so far, Meta's bet looks very smart.
And what about the national security issues? There's no one in national security that thinks open source is an answer.
No. In fact, as I say in the book, I have a lot of concerns about open source. I do think it is very hard to figure out how you're going to control these open source models. I do not think it's the analogy that people make to cybersecurity, where it's best to have the software code all out there in the open because people can find and patch the vulnerabilities. I just don't think that applies in this case, where you have a system that might have agency, where you could go out and perform tasks for you across the internet. Yes, it's possible you could make that system safer by having it open source. On the other hand, it just seems right now like it's so easy to take the guardrails off a system like that and have bad actors use that software to wreak havoc. And I think that risk is greater than the risk that we're going to not secure the system as well, or that they're going to miss out on some innovation because it was a proprietary model. I think the proprietary models make a lot more sense because you just have that much more control. It enables government also to have points at which it can intervene to have some guardrails and have some control as well. Whereas with the open models, it's much, much harder for government to do anything.
What about the Paris Action Summit? It is an action summit, not a safety summit. In February, Anne Bovaro is leading the charge and saying this isn't just about voluntary commitments. What's your expectation on what will happen there?
Yeah, I mean, I know the French really want to have something come out of this that will be binding, that will make some binding commitments on both maybe countries as well as companies. It's not clear to me that we're going to get there. I think the appetite for binding rules, particularly when it comes to the US and also some other countries in Asia, is not that high. I think we may end up with something sort of watered down. But the French definitely want something that's going to be binding. But it may be kind of binding to have another thing happen, like a firm commitment to have a firm commitment in place in 2 years' time sort of thing, as opposed to an actual piece of very concrete action. I think that's where we may end up, but we'll see. It is also true, though, that I think the company's position that you can do this all voluntarily, or that the voluntary commitments are enough, that position is not going to hold for much longer. So I do think you might see countries agree that there should be binding commitments placed on some of the companies. How that's enforced, though, is going to be interesting, because it's going to have to be enforced where this company's operator base. So there's going to be some interesting tension or play there between the countries about that.
Data is the power of AI. I'm wondering how you think countries that don't have large data sets or LLMs, how are they going to exist? How will those societies continue if they don't have enough to ingest? I mean, we here in the US, we complain and worry about what materials are already ingested in the system. But if you don't have large data sets, if you don't have a lot of language, a lot of written word, what happens to those countries?
Yeah, I think that's a real concern. Certainly, if this is going to depend on having a model that you train yourself, and if it really depends on really good local language skill, and your language is not a high resource language, that is going to be problematic, I think, for those countries. And I do think there's a risk they're going to fall further behind. It's going to be an impediment to their development. On the other hand, if you have a country where there is a lot of English spoken already, you can probably use some of the LLMs that have been built by companies in the US or companies in Europe, and have those work pretty well. And you can, it actually could empower your businesses. And I don't think there's a reason to mandate that everyone has to use an LLM that you've developed yourself in your jurisdiction. I think that, you know, there's a different issue about whether the LLM has to be hosted locally for certain use cases, then you might need data center capacity. But in terms of the actual data, if you can use somebody else's LLM, I think it's a great tool, and it could be a leveler in some ways. But yes, if you have to have one that is very fluent in a language that has been a low resource language, where there just is not a lot of digital material on which to train a system, that is going to be an impediment. And I think it's something that people are working on addressing, but it's going to take some time to address. It might need some development funding. I think that would be a good thing for some of the international development agencies to spend some money on, is help some of these countries that have low resource languages make sure that they can develop an AI model that actually functions in that language.
So you're talking about the World Bank, IMF, UN. UN is about to meet in September for the General Assembly, and their motto is AI for good.
Yeah, AI for good, AI for everyone. But I think if you're going to do that, that's a good use. World Bank funded the development of roads in the past, and I don't see why they can't fund the development of digital infrastructure as well.
Well, let's hope they do that. Jeremy Kahn, thank you for being with us. Your book, Mastering AI, A Survival Guide to Our Superpowered Future, is essential reading for all. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your work at Fortune Magazine on AI and other technology issues.
Oh, Tammy, thank you so much. I really appreciate you having me on.
Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.